welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, a Siblings podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If there's an author you'd like to see on the show, email me at steve@cinelinks.com, and I'll do my best to accommodate. Today on the show, we're talking with author David Arnold, all about his brand new book, The Electric Kingdom, a soft sci-fi which tells the story in the not-so-distant future, ravaged by a deadly fly flu, leaving a shell of the world behind and a few survivors doing everything in their power to stay alive. It's Station 11 meets the fifth wave in a genre-smashing story of survival, hope, and love amid a ravaged Earth. What David is truly looking to examine here is something only he knows, but from my point of view, he's looking to suggest that what good is finding the answers if you have no one to share them with, that life is a shared experience, and that includes friendship, happiness, and love. We talk about his career in music, our shared love of Ted Chiang, and whether or not The Electric Kingdom is a coincidental survival guide or dire warning. Speaking of warnings, this is a minor spoiler discussion, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled, better stop listening now, but please double back after you've read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, since things seem to get worse before they get better, I wish and I hope everyone continues to be safe and healthy, both physically and mentally. And if you've listened to the show, then you know I can't help myself. I like to call out certain things when they occur, and there's been a lot of racism lately online, especially Twitter, in a certain couple of groups of fandoms. And I think if you're in those fandoms, then you know what I'm talking about. So let's please continue to call this shit out collectively whenever we see it or hear it. Blocking them and hashtagging them is nice, but you got to report them. You got to call them out and humiliate them publicly, because that's the only way these bullies learn. Anyways, now that I've made my guests feel uncomfortable, David Arnold likes to write. He likes to write his books based on the contemporary and young adult genres. He has successfully written and published popular novels like Mosquito Land, Kids of the Appetite, and The Strange Fascinations of Noah Hypnotic, all of them receiving widespread acclaim. The list of his favorite places that he likes to go to include record stores, yes; Hogwarts, no; bookstores, yes; Middle Earth, yes. Being a musician himself, he loves all kinds of music, something I hope that we'll talk about. Oddly enough, speaking of music, he shares a name with David Arnold, the famous composer. We'll ask him which number David Arnold that is and who the deliverer is. If you haven't read this book, then you have no idea what I'm talking about. Speaking of which, he is here today to talk about his newest book. It's called The Electric Kingdom, which is being described as Station 11 meets the fifth wave in a genre-smashing story of survival, hope, and love amid a ravaged Earth. That's, I guess, kind of what it's about. We'll get way more into it than that, though. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
What an intro, I know.
It's all good.
As always, I do want to say that I hope you and your family and friends are safe and healthy during this shit-awful time.
Yeah, it has been shit awful, hasn't it? But luckily for us, we've just been very fortunate. It's been mostly shit awful for a lot of other people. We've been able to stay safe, and my wife's job has been great. So she's been working from home, and my kid has done wonderful in virtual school. So it's just been the three of us here at home since last March. And you know, luckily we're pretty obsessed with each other. So
Even better. I guess sort of off topic, I'm not a father myself. Everyone else in my life is a parent. Most of them complain about the at-home schooling, saying the kids are suffering because of it. What's your take?
You know,
and it's been different for everybody. We acknowledge that. Yeah,
sure. It is different for everyone. And we are just in a pretty great situation in that we only have one. First of all, we have friends who have four kids, and I can't even fathom.
Try zero to four. It doesn't even seem like reality. Yeah.
So just having one makes it just exponentially easier. And then also he is a homebody. He's always been a homebody. He loves Lego, and he loves, we make stop motion movies, the two of us together. And
awesome.
Pre-quarantine, whenever we would go out for any extended period of time, we would come home and he would literally run and hug the couch. He just loves being home, and
nice.
He gets that from me. And so we're very lucky. What is happening is awful. Mm-hmm. It has gone well in our house. So
that's good to hear. mostly it hasn't cramped my style, but there's a few exceptions. My three favorite things are movies, going to concerts, and conventions. So strike one, strike two, strike three. It's been so long now, and it's just I've just put it out of my mind because it's not coming back. Those things aren't coming back anytime soon, not in a normal way. So rather than be bummed out about it all the time, I just feel like it's just so far out. I've just put it out of my mind. And actually, I just had somebody ask me the other day what was like my last concert, and it was December 2019. I saw the Pixies, and that was the last show I saw. And I pray to whatever God anyone out there believes in that, you know, we'll get to do it again. But the thought of standing in a crowded room right now scares the shit out of me.
I know. And so going to the movies was always, I love going to the movies by myself. It was always a reward that I would give myself when I would complete a project, or also sort of if I was super stressed out and annoying my wife, she'd be like, go to the movies. Like, okay.
Yep.
I don't know when that's going to happen again. I mean, I know some movie theaters have figured out ways around it, and different people's comfort levels are at different places, but it's hard for me to imagine going to a movie theater, or like you said, going to a concert
This affects you directly too. And because you would be quickly, the book comes out February 9th, I don't know if you do this type of marketing, you'd be packing a bag.
Yeah, probably. Normally, and normally it's weird. There's so many reasons why I prefer this and so many reasons why I don't.
Sure, yeah.
I hated saying goodbye to my family for weeks on end and mm-hmm. constantly packing and unpacking. And it's a privilege to get to do what I do and to get to speak to readers. And also some of my best friends are authors that I would see on the road at various events and festivals. And I don't know. I mean, it is all virtual, so it's all through a screen. And I know that that's a lot of people's lives right now. And I just keep coming back to feeling grateful to have a job, but a job that I love and that has largely remained unaffected by all of this.
It's almost pandemic proof, isn't it? I've asked that question a lot though. And this for all the authors that I talked to the last, 12 months, and that seems to be the thing. It's like, it's great, but I miss seeing my friends, but it is a grind, getting out there and touring is a grind. And if there's a silver lining to be found at all, it's, these virtual events, these virtual panels and stuff, the reach is 100 to 1,000-fold, right? So normally it'd be, if you were fortunate enough, you'd be in a room with a few hundred people, maybe 1,000 if it was a big room. But now, I mean, it's the possibilities are not endless, but almost endless.
Yeah. And it also, I'm reminded of the ways that it's a more inclusive environment. There's some people who, for whatever reasons, are unable to leave their house can't afford it. Right.
Yep.
And so these virtual events make it so that really anyone and everyone, well, I say that, but I suppose you do have to have some sort of device and internet. And so maybe not everyone, but it is, in some ways, it is a lot easier for some people. It makes it possible for them to be part of these more communal events where it would have been harder before. So
absolutely. I've got friends who are just, get anxiety, and crowds and events are not their thing. So they love it, and they hope that some form of this sticks around if we ever do get back to, pre-COVID stuff, that, this virtual side of whether it's publishing or, the comic conventions, anything else, they hope it sticks around.
Yes, some hybrid form would be perfect.
Right, exactly.
Somewhere in the middle, yeah.
Right. So I read this this quote from you, and I wanted just to mention it real quick, so it just ties in with you being a father. Quote, it was after his wife gave him the news that he's going to be a father, he made him realize he needs to start taking his writing seriously. Eventually, author Arnold began developing the story of Mosquito Land. It was his honesty and dedication that enabled him to complete the writing part of the novel and publish it successfully. I think my question is, and it's beautiful sentiment for sure, was that a pragmatic decision, like as in you have a family to support now and it's time to buckle down? Or was that more referring to the type of writing you were doing?
it was pragmatic in a different way and from a very desperate place.
The best work. That's where the best work comes from.
Yeah. Pragmatic in the sense, not in a financial sense. At no point when I turned to get, when I got serious about writing, at no point did I think this is going to be how I pay the bills and, right. and how right. I help, you know. It was, you know, I had spent years in Nashville making music. For a long time that was in bands, and I, to be quite honest, didn't give a fuck if I made any music, any money at all. It just wasn't a concern. I was, I was making music that I believed in with my friends. And that was what I was there for and there to do. And I built a home studio over the years in Nashville and started, I would record my band's music. And then that led to me recording my own music, which led to me getting hired out by various, whether it's an indie film or youth camp videos. You know, Nashville has a, just a huge Christian music and contemporary music scene, which I wasn't really interested in being a part of, but there were plenty of jobs to be had in making music for videos for youth. And so I kind of turned to doing a lot of instrumental recording for hire, basically. And so that was kind of my, I mean, when I say made a living, a very, very modest living.
Right.
I was able to kind of at least justify that being my job.
Did you have healthcare? That's always the line in the sand.
You know, I didn't. Had it, my wife, you know, and this is part of that story, is that my wife had a great job. We, again, we have since moved, but she had a great job and it had benefits and the whole nine. And so when we found out that we were going to have a baby, you know, and it wasn't something that we were saying, we never want kids. It was just something we certainly didn't want kids then.
And you were still in Nashville at the time?
Yeah, we were still in Nashville. I was just really into what I was doing in my home studio, making music on the regular. And I wrote at that time, I was writing a little bit.
That's what I was going to ask you. Were you doing any writing at all during this period?
Yeah, I'd made some friends. Well, it started when I used to teach preschool. And I would read these and there are some picture book. Look, since I've been in the business longer, I've had a whole nother level of respect for picture book authors. The amount of artistic creativity and restraint that you have to write a good picture book is tremendous. Unfortunately, for a while there, and I'm talking back in the 90s, it was really the floodgates kind of opened for picture books. And so everybody left, right, and center was writing picture books. And there just ended up being, in my opinion, the market was flooded with these just awful picture books. So I was reading these to these kids and I was like, I could do this. And so that's kind of how it started, was me in terms of thinking about starting writing stories. That eventually evolved. I started writing sort of more middle grade, like humorous kind of Lemony Snicket style, you know, and it was all derivative. None of it was any good because I didn't take it seriously. I didn't think that I could write a novel. Like, who would do that? And so that's kind of when I wrote, and I did make some friends during this time. I've made some other author friends in Nashville. It's just such a, I don't know if you've ever been to Nashville, but it's such a creative hub of artists, you know, of all mediums. And I was able to make some friends who were writers and kind of see how they did it. And and then once we found out that the baby was on the way, you know, it was pretty much an overnight thing where, you know, we didn't have any family in the area. Couldn't afford childcare. My wife had this very regular job with benefits and I was recording music in my attic. So it was pretty much overnight decided that I was going to be a stay-at-home dad of our newborn baby. And that was when I was like, well, I can't record music with a baby in the room, but I guess I'll get serious about writing.
That's what I was going to ask you. So like, what, talk to me about like if it was a one moment or a sort of drawn out sort of, you know, decision where you put the guitar down and pick up the pen, right? Or yeah, in this case, plug in the laptop or whatever. Yeah.
I remember, it's so funny, cause I had been hired for a job, right around this time. And I'm a very type A, my mind is a very, like, everything has a compartment. It's a very, organized is the wrong word, but it's something in that family.
Crazy. We call it crazy. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
No, I'm just joking.
and so I knew I was going to finish that job. So I, So when I say overnight, I guess not literally, because I did finish that job. And okay. then, but then it very much was like an overnight, I'm going to write a novel. And I'd had an idea, you know, I moved around quite a bit when I was a kid, and I'd kind of had this idea for a story that I thought might be like a New Kid at School book, because that was an experience that I'd gone through many times. And okay. that slowly evolved into realizing that the real story wasn't where the art, where the character was moving to, but where they were moving away from.
Right.
And that then became Mosquito Land, which is, if you've read the book, it spends like three pages with where she's living, and the rest of the book is
it's you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then the rest of the book is her getting back home to where right. she came from. It's a road trip story. So, but yeah, I mean, it really was like, I turned to write this book that I just assumed no one would ever read. Mm-hmm. And it was a weird, very visceral. I mean, my memories of those first couple of years of his life are right under the surface. I can revisit them anytime I want, which is, I try not to very often, because inevitably I end up crying for one reason or another. But it's just it was a very visceral time for me, in the sense that I was the most desperate I've ever been. I had to say goodbye to a job that I loved, being recording music, and turn to something that I loved but assumed would never become a career. And kind of, there were moments of real bitterness on my part, feeling sort of forced into a corner, and then feeling kind of like I had to write my way out of it. Mm. So yeah, it was just a very bizarre time, heightened emotions.
You're reading my mind, because I was going to, my next question was, what was your emotional state during that time? Because you'd spent a lot of time invested in a musical career, right? So, yeah. And then, you know, just we'll put a pin in it, but you know, when you, that gig you're talking about, when you took that gig, were you saying, this is my last gig?
No, I had already said yes to it and was in the middle of it when we found out that my wife was pregnant.
Okay,
so I knew I was going to finish that job, and then I was going to have to say no. And it was in freelance work, when you start saying no, that's it. They don't call back.
Right.
You know, there's 100 people in line behind you who are ready to say yes. And I knew as soon as I started saying no to the people who would hire me, that was the beginning of the end in terms of that career.
How is your relationship with music now?
It's funny. I don't know if you've heard the metaphor of the fox or the hedgehog. There's a great sort of, you know, it's one of those things where it's like everybody boils down to one of two things.
Okay.
And in this case, it's you're a fox or you're a hedgehog. And
okay.
And the fox knows many things. It can play, it can hunt, it can love its family in its own way. It can kind of wander. It knows many things. The hedgehog knows one thing, and that's survival. And Hidden Brain is a podcast on NPR that I listen to every once in a while. And he does a great breakdown of this, much more in depth and worthwhile than I'm making it sound. But that was a very freeing moment for me when I heard that, because I realized I'm a hedgehog. I know one thing. I am incapable of having many irons in the fire. When I do something, that's what I'm doing, and I want to do it and it's not that one way is better than the other or right or wrong. It's just, it allowed me to think in a certain way that felt, to answer your question, I put down music and moved to writing wholeheartedly. And I think I spent years feeling guilty for that, because I did love music, and it was something I felt that I was good at. And being able to categorize it in that way kind of freed me to say, no, it's okay that this is how I operate. And I think since then, my relationship with music has been a lot more healthy. I mean, I will probably once a year, I'll go through about a month long phase where I'll pick up my guitar and kind of tinker around with some songs, but it feels very much like a hobby now, which it, you know, for a decade, it was something I was trying to make a career. So
sure.
I think it's healthier now than it was before, because it, you know, I've said before too, that like my career in music felt very much like I was banging my head against a door over and over again. And every once in a while, someone would open it up and be like, what do you want? and my career in books has just been, I lightly knocked on the door and they swung it open wide and said, come on in. It's just been way more
waiting
natural.
For you. Yeah.
Yeah. It very much felt like I discovered this thing that I didn't know existed and like it was made for me.
Right.
I'm way more, much more fulfilled, writing books than I ever was with music.
Okay, well, that's great. You know, I hope, I'm sure music will be a part of your life forever. I mean, I'm sure you listen to it all the time still. And
constantly,
are able to, yeah. Yeah, me too. So
yeah.
That's good to hear that it didn't destroy your love of music. And I mean, love in the general sense, right?
Right, yeah, not at all. Speaking
of books, though, let's talk books. Electric Kingdom, Coincidental Survival Guide or Dire Warning? I'll let you pick one. Which one is it?
So. Oh man, yeah, I don't know. I'm gonna opt out.
Coward, come on.
Yeah, no, I mean, intention is a hard thing for me with books because I almost never feel, at least not going into a project, like I know what I want or like I know what I'm trying to do. It is like it feels less cognitive than that, and I think there are times, this book is no exception, where not until the very end, when you start kind of crafting a narrative with your editor and with your publicist about how you're going to talk about the book, and you start to hear other people kind of say, well, here's what we think you should say in terms of what it's about and what you're, and you're like, oh, I guess it kind of is about that. Like, sometimes I don't realize really what the heart of the book is about until I'm done with it. So, that was kind of a tangent, but
yeah. No, that's fair. Definitely sounds like writing it was therapeutic in a way.
Yeah. I mean, the book is a post-apocalypse. It's set 20 years after the apocalypse. I'm way more interested in, I'm far less interested in how the world ends and more interested in the people surviving and how they're navigating the world after the fact.
Sure.
Just in books that I read, I love post-apocalyptic literature, and the idea that you have this sort of giant backdrop behind this sort of more intimate setting, being the characters kind of trying to live their lives. And I love that dichotomy. I first had the idea back in 2013, for a family who lived in a boarded up farmhouse in the woods.
Okay.
And I wasn't really sure where this farmhouse was. I didn't know who the people were who lived there, and I didn't know why it was boarded up. So for me, writing the book was almost like I just needed to figure out what was going on.
Right, sure.
Yeah.
That's kind of like when we read it.
Well said.
So I remember it showed up at my house, this book, you know, they send, I'm very fortunate, people just send me books to read and talk about.
That's great,
it's great. Oh, trust me, it's not lost on me how lucky I am in that sense. But I got to say, so I take it out of the package the publicist says, you're going to love this book. Didn't tell me anything else. I take it out of the package and my reaction, I knew right away my reaction was going to depend on one thing, whether that dog lives or dies. I'm a big dog person. So, I can't, you know, I mean, I can go down a list of other books and movies and stuff where the dog does die and it's scarred me for life. So,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we won't spoil that part of it, but I remember thinking that as soon as I took it out of the package and I was like, if I ever get a chance to talk to David, I'm going to mention that to him. But
you know, they put a dog on the cover and I thought this is going to be a thing where people are going to be like, well, I'll love it, but only if the dog lives. And it's, you know, I don't say what happens to the dog. What I will say is that I grew up with a family dog named Adidas who lived to be 18 years old. And okay. I loved that animal. Like, you know, like anyone who's loved a dog gets it. So I'd always wanted to write a dog in a book and this was my chance.
He's a good boy in this book for sure. It's funny though, how like, you know, no one cares what happens to the girl on the cover.
I know,
Nico doesn't get the same consideration.
Right. Yeah.
It's so funny. But, anyways, let's get into Electric Kingdom a little bit. first off, I'm a life is too short type of guy. So if I tell you like something, I mean it. So I really enjoyed Electric Kingdom. And
Thank you.
And we'll talk about why. I'm going to read the summary. It's a little long, but I'll read it anyways. It'll save you from having me to ask you what the book is about and then you answering that, which you've been asked who knows how many times at this point. So when a deadly fly flu sweeps the globe, it leaves a shell of the world that once was. Among the survivors are an 18-year-old Nico and her dog. On a voyage devised by Nico's father to find a mythical portal, a young artist named Kit, raised in an old abandoned cinema, and the enigmatic Deliverer, who lives life after life in an attempt to put the world back together. As swarms of infected flies roam the earth, these few survivors navigate the woods of post-apocalyptic New England, meeting others along the way, each on their own quest to find life and love in a world gone dark. The Electric Kingdom is a sweeping exploration of art, storytelling, eternal life, and above all, a testament to the notion that even an exterminated world, one person might find beauty in another. So here's a chunk what I wrote in my review. It's just a paragraph, so I'll just read it real quick. In attempting to understand the cause of the collapse, as some of our characters do, you soon realize it's not nearly as important as that the collapse happened at all. This is not to suggest some higher power decided Earth's time was up. This isn't that kind of story. No, it's more about our hubris as a species pushing the boundaries of its natural law to its limits. It's about our relationship with the planet and each other. Did I pick up what you were trying to put down or am I way off base?
No. Yeah. I think that's right.
I mean, that's one point of many, obviously that doesn't. But, I think what I was trying to see, you know, what I do get at in other parts of what I wrote down was, it's more about the journey than the destination, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And, and one of the things that I love in books that I, in other books that I read that I know infuriates some readers, you know, we all have different things that we love that other people hate. And for me, it's, I love a book that only gives a snapshot of the much larger picture. Mm-hmm. I like feeling like there's a really long timeline. And this story takes place on a very short period of that timeline. I really enjoy those sorts of stories. And so I think a natural sort of result of that then is going to be many readers, they're able to fill in those blanks in ways that they see fit and connect certain dots that maybe others don't connect. I think what you said is spot on, for sure. I definitely tried to leave a lot of, as you said, the apocalypse really is, it's, this book just isn't about how it ended and how it went down. It's
right.
But you do have to offer like some of that so that people can kind of get a sense for the, I mean, that's the world building of this book. I think that your take is spot on.
It kind of goes to this thing where like, you know, in absence of nothing, you begin to understand what's important in life, I think. And that's maybe one of the, you know, journeys these folks are on. It's sort of like, I was reminded of, what was that kid's name? McCandless, the Into the Wild fella who went on his journey there. And in the end, you know, he sort of steals a Dr. Zhivago line, but it's something like, what's the point of happiness if you can't share it? That's the sentiment anyway. So I get a lot of that from this story as well. In the end, is that?
For sure. And I love the idea. I mean, so Nico, the sort of the primary main character, I feel like there are two or three main characters, but I do think she's probably the primary main character. And her entire journey is sort of handed to her in a thinly veiled fictional story told by her father.
Right.
And in terms of intention, that is one of the things that I knew going in was that I wanted to find a way to literally save our characters with a story. I feel like I've explored, and many authors explore, the metaphorical ways that story and art save us. I wanted to look at like how, first of all, what does art and storytelling look like 20 years after an apocalypse? And then second of all, how can we save these characters in a story? And I thought that was a really compelling exploration for me.
Well, that was one of the points you make in the book. And I really thought it was really great and spot on. And this idea, you know, that immortality isn't a gift from the gods, but it's something we can create in art, literature, in whatever.
Yeah. And the sci-fi sort of, you know, there's fringe edges of sci-fi in the novel.
It's soft, I would say. Soft sci-fi.
It very much is a post-apocalyptic novel, but there is soft is a great word, sort of sci-fi angle, which was really, that was one of the most fun things in writing the book was, there's an, there, well, I'm trying to figure out how to what to not spoil here.
But yeah, it's hard.
May or
it's
may
hard,
not
yeah.
be an anomaly happening, and then just sort of what is that? Where did it come from? What does it mean? Yeah, it was just that was a really fun thing. And there are some authors who have to have a very detailed outline before they really start, and there are some books that require that. And for me, this book was I had some ideas, but a lot of it was me figuring out things along with my characters as I'm writing.
It's told in the third person, and there's three characters basically, three mains, I guess we'll say, right? Like,
sure. Yeah, three points of view.
Sure. And, Nika, Kit, the beautiful Kit who I would protect with my life. Yes. And then the mysterious deliverer, it's kind of like this overseer type character. What was that like, sort of, just sort of break that down? Was that the idea from the beginning, this tripartite, sort of form?
Yeah, I had when I was first fleshing out the idea for this farm, this boarded up farmhouse in the woods, I thought, I had sort of this just folder that I would come back to over months and even years and kind of dump ideas into. And one of the turning points was that piqued my interest was when I thought about the idea of this family they live in this boarded up farmhouse, and for whatever reason, it's not safe to leave, but there is a person who literally brings them food, every month or every 2 months. And this person wears like an astronaut suit. Right. And I just started thinking that would be really interesting. Now who is that person and what is their situation? And, the idea of it being an omniscient, omnipotent being and it being not, I didn't want it to be supernatural. It wasn't, this was going to be an actual physical human being and how were they able to do that? And, one of the things that I said before about snapshot storytelling, I also love Ted Chiang is one of my all time favorite authors.
Oh, hold on. We're going to get to Ted. Don't worry.
Okay.
We have that in common. I am obsessed with Ted Chiang.
What I love the most about his writing is that you don't, and I don't, first of all, I don't presume to be on any level near Ted Chiang, but one of the things I love about his writing is that you don't fully understand what's happening, but you fully trust that he does. And because of that, you're able to enjoy this experience that you can't explain. Right. And that was sort of a North Star for me with this book, was being able to connect these dots myself, even if the readers couldn't.
Well, the deliverer definitely gives it a sense of a chessboard type of feel, right? Like the pieces are being moved and not so much controlled, but manipulated, I guess. And so you created this law of I can't remember what it's called now. Law of peripheral adjustments. You came up with this concept for the book, right? And
right.
Really fascinating. And I bought it so much that I had to look it up. I'm like, I've never even heard of this law before.
That's great.
It makes sense. It feels like it's something that at least, philosophers should be arguing about. And so that was a wonderful idea. And it's hard to talk about that without spoilers, but I kind of just hinted at it with, with the, this chess, chessboard type of thing, but
sure.
Yeah, like there is something, that is not necessarily controlling what happens, but definitely, let's put it this way, has a keen interest in making sure things turn out a certain way.
Yeah. And I think that you can say that, it does sort of, explore the notion of free will what are your characters when they do something and they think it's on their own, was it in fact on their own, and right. and did they choose that, or was something put in front of them that of course they would choose? And so there is part, but the other hard part of that was I came up with the law of peripheral adjustments, which is basically the deliverer has this law where they're only allowed to help or hinder in very subtle ways.
They've given themselves a set of rules, basically.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
But once I established that, I had to show what happens if you don't live by that law. And that was a hard thing to do, because the deliverer is really, I would say the deliverer is secondary behind Nico and Kit. And I very much wanted the book to feel like post-apocalyptic, set in reality, so that when you got to the deliverer sections, it was jarring. You're just, and it even the Deliverer's points of view, the chapters that are in the Deliverer's points of views are in first person for that reason.
Right.
That when you hit a Deliverer chapter, it feels like a different book almost.
Well, and a lot of this character also takes completely over the narrative. Like the last, once the gig is up,
right.
You totally just like hand it over to this person. Right. So, that's the point where then, you know, you start, I don't, whatever you want to call it, filling in the blanks, putting the pieces together for us, you know, like, you know, either making us fist pump or desk pound, depending on what ideas you had going into
right.
it. But, that's, you know, I got it. And that really makes the book feel like two different books in a way.
Yeah.
Like there's a real conscious shift you make there about, like I said, around the 66.6%, you know, way through.
How did the
ending, would it seems to me like you would have had to like, okay, I need to stop.
Yeah.
and people will understand that when they read the book, but you get into a loop, right? And you got to figure out a way out of it.
Right. I could have kept going for a much, it's already a pretty long book, but I could have kept going
for
much longer. I also, before I even go any further, have to credit my editor, Dana Ladig at Viking. She and I had many long phone conversations about how to put everything together and make it work. And I had a giant, I unrolled a sheet of wrapping paper, just brown wrapping paper on my dining room table and sat down for at least a week and just outlined the timelines.
Right.
Just to make sure everything was fit, you know, was fitting. At a certain point, I knew that there were going to be, you know, there is I believe there is resolution and that it does complete itself in the way that it should. Mm-hmm. There are going to be probably plenty of people who disagree with that. And I'm completely comfortable with that. It certainly is an unconventional resolution for the characters. I'm not sure how else it could have gone.
Right. I guess I could maybe put it this way. Like, let's say there's, you know, stories A through Z. Story A wraps up.
Right.
I think, you know, what I really, really love, and I got really mad actually, this was about a month ago, somebody put something on Twitter about, I don't think it was a poll, but they were asking like, who the hell reads prologues anymore? And I'm like, I fucking read prologues. What are you talking about?
I love a prologue.
I love prologues and I love this prologue, and this prologue just like pays for itself, especially when you get further into the book and especially when you get to the end, like, you know, and it's sort of funny now. It's funny. This is how our brains work, right? But this leads to me now bringing up Ted Chiang. One of the things, you know, you mentioned Ted Chiang in the book as, you know, Kit's a reader and he loves, and there's some books he just can't part with. And Ted Chiang books are one of them, some of them. And this story reminded me of Arrival, of Story of Your Life.
Yeah.
And for sure. Now in that film, not the Sapir-Whorf theory, of course, that has more to do with, you know, how language affects, how language can rewire the brain and how it affects the way we think, but right. more with this idea of, you know, the heptapod's way of non-linear thinking, right. Writing and speech. That definitely plays into this book. And I'm not, this is not accusing you of any, you know, plagiarism or stealing or anything. Not at all. But there is, you know, you do mention Ted Chiang and it's hard, you know, it's hard not to think of Story of Your Life and stuff like that in the way that you tell this book. Right.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, when I think about my favorite books and movies, I can always come up with, well, here's who I would bet that person was influenced by. And
sure.
I make no bones about it. I saw Arrival in 2015 when it came out. I went to it with my brothers thinking I was going to an alien movie.
Mm-hmm. I remember I saw the theater three times, and I remember them. And I remember when I saw it the first time, and I mean, I was kind of in already, but
yeah.
I remember going to see it and I'm like, they did not market this film well.
Right.
Correct.
You know, and it opens with the, first of all, I want to say I write to film scores and I wrote this book to Johan Johansson's.
Oh,
film
may he rest in peace.
May he rest in peace. Yeah.
What a talent. Yeah.
And so that film score is so brilliant in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But it, if I remember correctly, the film opens with Max Richter's The Nature of On the Nature of Daylight. Is that what it is? On the Nature of Daylight. Yep. And you know, with the character mourning the loss of her young daughter, and I'm just immediately bawling like at the beginning of the right at the beginning of the movie. And
oh, that cello,
oh,
right?
Like, yeah.
Tears it's your just, heart.
Man,
out.
Yeah. If you don't feel something at that,
you
it's just such a and I it's escaping me now, the screenwriter, but I love because you know, Story of Your Life is such a brilliant story. And to take that and make the, I mean, like fundamental changes. Heiserer, I think, is the
story. Well, not only fundamental changes, but it was a short story, and
right,
like to make as I mean, all of Ted's stories, I guess, are short stories, aren't they?
Right.
But to fundamentally change it in a way, but then making it 2-hour movie, right?
Like, right. Expand on certain ideas that Ted Chiang kind of touched on. And I love them both, the movie and the short story, for different reasons.
Yeah, me too.
And for sure. I mean, I even use, you know, a Ted Chiang quote at the beginning of the book, and I don't even call the prologue a prologue. I just call it a giant circle.
Right.
Yeah, no, for sure. That movie is one of my all-time favorites, and that all of Ted Chiang's stories really are among my favorites, for sure.
Sure. Now, obviously, the trap in writing a story that's nonlinear or has loops in it is what we just talked about. How do you? It's like a roundabout in England or something, right? Like it's like that vacation movie where they couldn't get out of it. You know, how do you get out of it? So it's like you seem pretty satisfied with the way you got out of it. Was that like that from the beginning? Was that easy for you? Did you have that clear picture in your head of how you were going to get out of it?
Well, I did at the very beginning, and then I finished a draft in which it was the whole format of the book in the early drafts. Actually, it was formatted the way Cloud Atlas, David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, mm-hmm. is formatted. That sort of I can't remember the term for it now, but it's sort of a nesting doll kind of build. You know, you tell half the story, and then another half of a story, and then another half of a story, and then you kind of I don't know if you've read Cloud Atlas or not, but I had formatted it in a certain way where it began with that prologue in Traffic and ultimately eventually landed back in Traffic with those characters. Mm-hmm. And when my editor first read it, she was, and rightly so, kind of said, you can't have the resolution of the entire book be with these people who we haven't seen since the prologue.
Right.
And I was like, that's really smart and makes a lot of sense, damn it. And then that led to a larger realization for me, which was that I was sacrificing story and character at the altar of format. Mm. And I was so intent on having the book be formatted in this certain way that it wasn't doing justice to the story. So I kind of had to scrap everything and rewrite large swaths of the book. And from that point on, I wasn't sure what the resolution was going to be. It took a lot of doing. And there was again, I don't want to give spoilers, but there was a moment when I realized that our main character was going to see someone at the very end, and that just seeing that person opened up a whole new world of possibilities. And for me, that was the resolution that I was looking for.
Oh, perfect. One thing that I really did appreciate about the book, and it sort of, you know, can happen in post-apocalyptic type stories, that you didn't exploit, you know, that side of humanity, which often comes in these situations, right? That you hint at evil more than you display it. I mean, there's one or two highly uncomfortable moments for sure, and you definitely play with our sense of imagination. But it's not grisly; it's more anxiety-inducing, right? It's never graphic.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, there's a question, but I just wanted to say I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Because I don't, you know, like this, you know, that trend of like torture porn movies that was going around for a while is not. Sorry, I don't. Homie, don't play that. but having said that, you know. I don't, not knowing what type of, what keeps you up at night, but you know, where's the line for you is, you know, in that sense, and are you just conscious of it, or is that just, you know, this just comes out of you and it's already just sort of, censored automatically?
Yeah, no, it takes a lot of thought and a lot of, you know, it was a hard line to walk because you want the world to feel dangerous.
Yeah.
And you know there are going to be people in this world who do hurt other people. And I mean, that's true of our world now, obviously, but what would that look like in this post-apocalyptic world? And I've read enough post-apocalyptic books, you know, Cormac McCarthy having people eat babies. Like, I'm not doing that. And my first
the Democrats drafts, do that. We don't need to do that. Yeah. Yeah.
First few drafts, there was really very little danger at all, aside from the flies. You know, you have these sort of ravenous swarms of flies, and
yep.
humanity kind of, our characters had to be cognizant of them for sure and try to be safe. But I didn't have a lot of dangerous people. And I had some early readers who were like, you know, don't go too far, but we need to see something. And that led to the creation of some characters that that I think you're referring to, which it gives you enough, I hope, to kind of be nervous for the characters. And certainly these characters, in my opinion, do go too far. My hope is that the way I portrayed it was not showing that, but definitely giving you the impression of that.
Well, that's the part about when I said, you know, you play with our sense of imagination.
Right.
And our imagination, that's not always a positive outlook. You know, we can imagine all sorts of things. You didn't exploit it, I think. And you're right, though, especially the one, you know, there's one scene, but there's another scene. You'd be a great horror writer, I think, because, you know, there's one character in the gas station and stuff like that. And just like, I am ratcheted right up reading those scenes, right? Like, I am just like, okay, get out, run. You know what I mean? Yeah, so it's like, yeah, you'd be, if you ever decided to, you know, go in that direction, I think you'd be all right.
Oh, well, thank you.
So I think, you know, we'll wrap up here, but you know, there's a line in the book and I really think, you know, my question is, you know, what's the message you want people to take away from this book? And I think it dawns on me where there was a line I wrote down when I read this book. I'm glad I wrote it down because I read this book a while ago now. But so anyways, the line is, the truth was it didn't really matter where it led or how it got here, whether alien or machine or black hole on Earth, Nika felt planted in a new light of love. Kind of gets it, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean,
that's the overriding. The other stuff is, you know, ultimately, you know, intelligent and clever and I enjoyed it, but it's ultimately window dressing, right? I mean, if this is, you know, this is kind of the point.
Yeah. I think ultimately the story is about a father who wants to spare his daughter pain mm-hmm. and death and, you know, don't we all, I mean, I, sure. so, yeah. so yeah, for sure. And to a certain extent, it was me wanting to try something new and see if I could get away with it. And also just like story consumption, I'm a big believer that story input equals story output, and what you're consuming is eventually going to find its way into what comes out of you. And these are the kinds of stories that I've been consuming for the last 5 or 6 years. And
right on.
I think this was sort of an inevitable outcome of that.
Well, The Electric Kingdom comes out February 9th. You know, we've talked about it a lot. It's an emotionally resonant story and it's full of, you know, plenty of great moments of grace and honesty. I think the book asks more questions than it provides answers for, but I also think, you know, that's a good thing. And I think it's also a roadmap. And it's funny, I didn't even know you were a teacher, but you know, I would, like all good teachers, you've sort of, you know, you've handed us the compass, pointed us in the right direction. And then now what we do with that information, you know, we'll probably fuck it up, you know, but who knows? It dawned on me when I got to the end of the book that, you know, that ultimately we want to live in a world with more kids. You know, so let's hope that's the case. Before I let you go, though, I do want to ask your writing setup. I'm always fascinated with your physical writing space. How, because, you know, especially during when everyone's stuck at home, some people are crammed in a closet. You know what I mean? Like, it's
right.
What's your setup?
Yeah, no, we're set up pretty well. I've got live
an actual office or.
Well, not really, but I've never had an actual office. It's okay. Basically, we have a house that was built in the 50s that has an add-on in the back. So basically the front of the house has what used to be the living room, mm-hmm. which has a sort of a big window that looks out at our neighborhood. Back when we bought the house 5 or 6 years ago, I just set up my office here. So my office is an old living room, basically.
Okay, beautiful. Sounds nice.
Yeah, I love it. It's really good. I don't have a door, which I can see why that would be necessary for some people. But, you know, with it just being the three of us here and my wife and kid, they both have their own rooms. So I don't really need one.
No, if you've got good house management, you don't need doors, right?
That's right.
I don't like to give money to pandemic profiteers. So that means I don't like to promote the bald guy. Do you have a preferred method for people to buy your book? Is there a local place you like to push? Or
just, yeah, absolutely. You know,
bookshop.org is always a good one
too. Bookshop's great. I love bookshop.org for sure. People can currently pre-order signed personalized copies through my local independent bookstore, Joseph Beth, here in Lexington.
Say it again.
The bookstore is called Joseph Beth, but to pre-order the book, just go to davidarnoldbooks.com.
Davidarnoldbooks.com. Okay.
And there's a link on the books page that'll take you straight to the bookstore and you type in how you want me to sign it. And yeah.
Perfect. Well, that's great. I can't thank you enough. Continued safety and health. You know, this thing's not going away anytime soon by the looks of it. So yep. Sounds like you guys got a pretty good system in place. Just stay bunkered down. Hey, keep writing more books. That'll keep you indoors, right?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm trying. Yeah. And thank you so much for having me. This was really fun. It was a real pleasure.
No problem. Appreciate it, David. There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to David for chatting with me today. The Electric Kingdom is a pretty great sci-fi read, and I think it will definitely appease your sensibility. But like all good fantasies, there's a deeper meaning here that I'm sure if you take anything away from this reading at all, you'll be glad you took the time to do so. Make sure you head on over to davidarnoldbooks.com to see what he's got planned for the release and how to get your hands on a signed copy courtesy of Joseph Beth Books at josephbeth.com. Another reminder that we're in the middle of Black History Month, so be sure to support Black authors all month long, all year long, by not only buying reading books from Black authors, but supporting them on social media. Boosting their work is a huge help, so do it however you can. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen. Head on over to sendlinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.